My mind visualized myself doing that by handing you the keys and going off the cliff. I felt the sensation of falling off. All of a sudden, this weird feeling of a massive sphere force started to get bigger and bigger in front of me. Isn't this exciting? Until I felt crushed. No. I felt I got stuck to the board or sphere as it tries to lift off again, bringing me along. I didn't feel bad with the feeling. Instead, it felt like going into an unknown space, which I don't know what it is. I couldn't feel my body there, but I'm still aware of sound as a cottage door started banging and I couldn't explore further. I kept nudging my mind with words, go on, to let it go further, but it couldn't. Am I going in the wrong direction in meditation, or is this normal? I've meditated for a year on and off and never got beyond stillness of mind. This is the first time I'm experiencing something different. I tried lying down on bed meditation. It did work for my shoulders. They don't hurt as much now, only sore. Thank you for the advice. One more query. When does one know when to go into watching the breath? As I always wanted to still the mind with good foundation before moving forward. Okay, now that's one of those weird experiences which are really cool. And sometimes you can't control these things. As long as you don't feel bad, you let go, then it's sort of, you say that it got stuck to a sphere and it tried to lift off, bringing me along. You didn't feel bad with the feeling and felt like going to unknown space. Let yourself go there. I don't know, did you ever watch Star Trek? Star Trek. You know, the movie? Not the movie, it's a TV series when I was young. Star Trek, where it always used to say, to boldly go where no one has gone before. No, to boldly go where no one has gone before. This is, you know, the where monks and bold people, well, actually says boldly go, to go to where no one has been before. It's interesting. And you can't really do much except just go along for the ride. So you did that little bit of letting go, you know, by imagining giving the keys to me, and you had a nice feeling. Now, my advice is, you know, you just go along as much as possible. Most people stop those experiences because they get afraid. And sometimes it seems here that the writer had the experience, but it didn't have enough oomph to actually to go much deeper, and he just stopped as it was. So you can still hear the sound, but the body would disappear. So you're getting there. So, and you said you wanted to have it go on, to go further, but it couldn't. Sometimes that's just the nature of things, because you haven't got enough letting go to go all the way. So you did very well. You didn't interfere with it, but you didn't have enough momentum to go deeper. That's all it is. Is this normal? Absolutely. It is fine. It's wonderful that you're starting to let go. And the last question, you're trying to not, you never got beyond stillness of mind because, you know, you always wanted to watch the breath. Oh, so you always wanted to get stillness before you start watching the breath. When you make decisions, should I go here? Should I go there? Should I stop counting the breath and then just watch the breath? Or should I do this and should I do that? The best thing is just actually to do nothing and let the mind choose. Because then meditation becomes a natural process. And as I mentioned, as you become still, then your body does disappear. And thinking stops. And then the only thing moving at a certain stage of meditation is your breath. So everything else is vanished. You're not thinking about the past or the future, so all that sort of disappears. You can feel the body and that disappears. And then the only thing which is moving is your breathing. So it's natural that even if you don't go looking for the breath, at a certain stage of meditation, you just become aware of the breath. It just comes to you. Remember I was saying a few days ago that when things are still, they disappear. And that's actually what one really does. You close the eyes, and on the inside of the eyelids is a blackness. If you really notice, the first time you close your eyes, you actually see that blackness, which is why if you're looking at a light, it's not black, it's a bit red.
But you're seeing the inside of your eyelids, but there's nothing moving there. It is still. So after a short while, sight turns off. Remember I was saying smell and taste are very easy to turn off. And let's see, other part of feeling in the body, there's always an ache or a pain here. So if you can get yourself comfortable, most of the body, because it's not moving, it's not comfortable, it just disappears. If you're not thinking backwards and forwards, the thinking is what sort of stops things disappearing. But if the thinking is silent, the mind can only notice things which move. So if everything else is stopped, the last thing which is moving is your breath going in and out, in and out, in and out. So that's why the breath comes up, whether you like it or not, as a natural part of the process of letting go. And as I said to a few people, then you get your breath nice and still and peaceful. You relax it until it becomes so smooth that there's hardly any change in the breath, which means that then that disappears. So the disappearing comes from stillness. So when the body disappears, that's wonderful. You feel so good. So great, you did a nice thing. And when it comes to should I watch the breath, should I not watch the breath, the best thing is to remind yourself to shut up and just go by nature. When my breath disappears and no nimitta, what should I watch, put my attention to? Whatever you're experiencing. So the breath has disappeared, a nimitta hasn't arisen, you are still conscious. What are you conscious of? So find out the answer to that question. And then you'll find nimittas will come up pretty quickly. It's similar if we didn't have all these lights on all over the place in China Grove. If you went out from a lit room into the dark garden, you can't see at first. So you got out from the lit room, you go into the garden, so what am I supposed to see? You can't see anything. But you just stay there for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, the pupils of your eyes get bigger, allowing in more light, and then you start to see the shapes of the trees and the path and everything else. You get your night vision. And that's so similar to what happens when the breath disappears in your meditation. At first, a coarse object has disappeared. You've got to wait until the mindfulness becomes strong enough to see more subtle objects. Just like going out from a lit room into the darkness. So if the breath has disappeared and the nimitta hasn't arisen yet, just stay there. And just be aware of this, whatever it is you're aware of. You're aware of something. Otherwise you'll be unconscious. Be aware of that, and it's soon, just like the darkness, you know, when you first go out from a lit room, then you start to see things. So don't go thinking and choosing. Just stay there, stay still. You soon get to know what you're seeing. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist meditating on the breath and obtaining jhana? The difference may be is if you're a Buddhist and then you get jhana, you don't change. And if you're a non-Buddhist and you get jhana, you become a Buddhist. Maybe. I don't want to convert anybody. But sometimes when you see these things, they just give you a different way of looking at life. So it's just what happens to you. So it doesn't really, really matter, because sometimes these experiences, when you really get a big experience, then even if you're a Buddhist and you get a jhana, and then you realize, yeah, you thought you were a Buddhist, but you weren't really. You just believed, you didn't know anything. But after the jhana, then you're a real Buddhist. You understand what we're doing here? Ajahn Brahm, read the question slowly. And they've got a picture. And this is the second time. Oops, someone's gonna shoot me. 39 years today as a monk. Well done, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, it's the 5th of December today. 39 years ago today, I became a monk. The best 39 years of my life. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell us a little about the average day of a monk at your monastery? Like, how much time is spent in meditation each day? Some of the chores done in noble silence. Is there a Dhamma talk each day, etc.? Now, there is no regular routine at Bodhinyana Monastery. So there is not an average day. Every day is beyond average. It's better than average. So you can't really say what happens. And it really depends. There's always some chores going on. You know, there's, for me, it's like talking to everybody, making sure the guests are looked after, and then there's funerals. There's two funerals, one for today and another one going tomorrow, which monks have to look after. So there's lots of little other stuff which you cannot plan for. They just happen. And so we do some of the chores, some of the building work and other stuff, fixing up the cars, and even coming up here to fix things up over in Jhana Grove, or to do some weeding and stuff. There's lots of stuff which the monks do. And the reason we do that, we want to try and do maybe 4 mornings a week of chores. The rest of the time is free time for the monks. So it's only 2 hours a day. Afternoons and evenings are all free. And Monday, Saturday and Sunday are also free for the monks. So there's a lot of free time. And the reason why I like to do chores, even if there wasn't anything to do, even if you gave me $10 million so we can hire servants to do all that work, I would still not take it, because it's good for, you know, the monks to do a bit of service. Because when you do a bit of work and a bit of service, you know, for keeping the monastery or Jhana Grove or something going, it gives you a lot of happiness, and that happiness will translate into the joy of meditation. The classic story was just before the rains retreat in India, one of the Buddha's chief female disciples, Visakha, invited the Buddha and the monks to her house to give the meal of the day. And now, while she was in the house, it was time to actually to come. So she sent one of her servants, her maids, over to the monastery to invite the monks. The meal's ready, come for the food. And it just happened that there was a big rainstorm that morning. So the monks took off all their clothes and bathed. Now remember, this was a time when there was no showers or piped water. And usually the monks and the nuns, they would bathe in the rivers, or maybe a pond if there was a pond, but especially in the rivers. Now this was the rainy season, so the rivers were flooding. The current was too dangerous to bathe there. So they took the opportunity, a heavy rainstorm, let's all have our shower. So when the maid came to the monastery, all she saw was a bunch of naked men. And just like these days, you know, if you came to Bodhinyana to see all the monks naked, you know, what would you do? You'd just turn around and go home and say, there's no monks there, there's just these weirdos, these creeps. And then this lady Visakha was smart enough, she'd go back again. She's a really clever lady. And of course the maid went back, and now all the monks had finished their bath, had dried off and were wearing their robes. So she said, monks, please come for the meal. So they all came for the meal, including the Buddha, and then afterwards, you know, Visakha said, you know, look, I realize what had happened, you're all having a shower, but you know, we lay people, you know, may not care about such things, but you know, it's a bit sort of creepy to see naked men in a so-called monastery. So can I please ask you, you know, to, when you bathe out in the open, to wear a little cloth around your private parts, you know, so you don't appear to be weirdos. And the Buddha said, that's a good idea, but we haven't got the cloth. And said, may I be the one who offers all these bathing cloths for the rains to all the monks. And may I also, while I'm at it, offer the same thing to the nuns as well. And while I'm at it, you know, there's so many people come, you know, to this monastery, you know, for the rains retreat because the Buddha's here. And know some of them, they don't know where to go on alms round. So the first day they come to this monastery, can I give them a standing invitation to my house so they can get their first meal, the very first day, and afterwards they'll settle in. And also, if they're leaving to go off travelling somewhere, Can I also ask them to come to my house for their meals, so I can also ask if they need anything, some slippers or something for their journey? And I was also noticing that, you know, when a monk gets sick, other monks look after you. And so, you know, that monk who is sick may need special food. So can they always come to my house and I'll give them special food for the time of the sickness? And also those who look after sick monks, they won't have time to get their own food. So can I feed them as well? And the Buddha says, that's asking a lot. You know, and you just want to do it yourself and you won't allow other people to do it. He said, yes. And the Buddha asked why. And then this incredibly wise female disciple told the Buddha, said, well, if you allow me to have those privileges, I know that every monk or nun who gets, say, a jhana, or gets to be a stream winner, once returner or non-returner, has eaten at my house at least once when they first came. That they would have been wearing some of my robes for bathing. And when I remember that I've helped them, that will give me so much happiness that when I meditate, I will use that happiness to get my body very peaceful, my mind still, to enter the jhanas, to see the Dhamma, and to get enlightenment myself. And the Buddha was so impressed with her wisdom. Yes, that's how it works. So he gave her those privileges just for her, because of her wisdom. Now, you can see any service which you do, any generosity or just helping just cut the carrot for lunch, all those little bits of kindness and generosity, never underestimate them. They make the mind bright and happy. So the meditation actually improves. And you really get some wonderful meditations with a little bit of service. Sometimes that you wonder, and it's very cheap to come to Jhana Grove, and sometimes you say, well look, I can afford a little bit more. If I give a bit more, can I be excused from kitchen duties? And the answer is, yeah, we can employ someone to do that for you. But you wouldn't get as much joy. And it wouldn't be as good for your meditation. When you're doing some service and some giving, not just writing out a check, that's just too easy for some people. But just doing a little bit of service, cleaning up, that is a cause of joy and happiness, which gets your meditation going. That's why I insist that all the monks do some work, somewhere, to do some service, because without that, their meditation will not be successful. So that's why we do those jobs. Not to, if you're always working, of course it doesn't work, you just get tired, you don't have time to use that good karma of service. If you do just the right amount of help and service, then it gives you so much of a boost to your meditation. So that's actually how we work. But sometimes we also have monks, they go on their little retreats. So there's about 4 or 5 monks now. You'll never see them because they're off in their huts for 2 weeks on a personal retreat. Sometimes we just take food to them and we don't see them. They don't do any chores. And when they're finished, another few monks go on their personal retreat. Because, you know, we built this monastery and Jhana Grove to be low maintenance, so you don't have to spend too much time, you know, maintaining it or cleaning it. So we have service, that's an important part of the meditation practice. So even if you gave $1,000 a day to come here, I will still insist you do kitchen duty. You can't get out of it. So that makes sense to you? I hope so. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can a foreigner become a nun in Dhammasara Monastery? No, only English people can. I'm English, you're all foreigners. Of course you can. You're mostly foreigners, aren't you? You haven't got any indigenous people yet. 7 different countries. Very good. Of course you can become a nun at Dhammasara Monastery. Foreigners, one-legged people. Anybody, any disadvantage? This is the nice thing about Buddhism and enlightenment. You can be physically disadvantaged, mentally disadvantaged or whatever, and As I mentioned yesterday, it's amazing just how many people, you know, you give them a chance, and it's not just any disability or where they came from. That's not really that important, but what you do with what you've got, that's very important. So it's wonderful you can have this openness to accept people. Dear Ajahn, the Anagarika who stepped on the ant's nest is not stupid. He was just being careless and had done a stupid thing. My compassion to him. Oops. That's a trouble. When I talk so much, you're always going to make a mess of yourself. Yeah, it was true. And he was driving a tractor. He did a stupid thing. He wasn't stupid. You know that story I said about the two children in the supermarket? Okay, you caught me out. Why there are no mosquitoes and a lot of flies in jhana groves? I think it must be the flies are so disturbing they drive away the mosquitoes. I don't know. The flies are disturbing, but they are good testers to see if you may still get angry. Is that right? It's just the time of the year. This is the Australian forest and this is part of nature. The flies come out this time of year. If you come in January for the retreat or April, you won't see any flies. They only come out this time and then they disappear. So, you know, it will pass, you know, and they don't do any harm. It's not like the flies, say, in India, which have got all sorts of diseases on them, probably, I don't know. But the flies over here are just so clean. So you can let them go up your nose and out again. They're only exploring. And they don't do any harm. I remember once talking about hypocrisy. I was giving a talk on meditation in Nolamara Temple. And I was saying that, oh, don't worry about the flies. It's only feelings. It's not a big thing. They're not dangerous. They don't carry diseases. They don't bite and sting you like mosquitoes do. And when I said that, okay, let's meditate. And straight away, a fly came onto my face. And I thought, oh God, I can't wash it away. Because I've just been saying just how everybody else would just let it be. So I did just let it be. And I noticed an interesting thing. Because this fly, you know, they did circumambulation around my mouth. They didn't just stay there. They started walking around. And going around. And then they did go around three times. It's a mark of respect. And what I noticed is it's only tickly. It's the edges of your mouth are far more sensitive than the top and the bottom. So it's okay. Once they got past this bit, it's okay. But when they're coming, this is going to be tickly again. It's very sensitive here and here. And they just went three times around and they flew off. So it doesn't kill you. You just have to change your perception, that's all. It's just a tickly sensation. It's nothing dangerous at all. And after a while, when you accept it, it's easy to bear. It's not much in life with these flies. So I see many of you got this little net. So I got a net when I walk over in the afternoon, and I wore it this afternoon. But, you know, it's not a big thing having the flies. There's many more irritations in life which are far worse than that. And of course, in your rooms, you don't have the flies. In here, you don't have the flies. And you know, if you really do get a fly in here, just leave it alone. It's a wonderful meditation just to let it be. And the trick of letting it be is always be in the present moment. In the present moment, it's easy. You're just enjoying this feeling. It's when you think of the future, I can't stand this any longer. That is where it becomes unendurable. When you project the present moment into the future, that's where it becomes a problem. So it really trains you to be in the present moment. If you rush off into the future, it becomes really difficult. So there's only flies. Dear Ajahn, I find Ajahn Chah's simile of the mango orchard very helpful. Where can I find a reference in the sutta to do nothing and everything falls into our hands? Much thanks. I don't know a sutta there except for that one which is enlightenment is a natural process, where it says from the start of things, just like getting some inspiration up. Once you have inspiration, you don't have to think, you don't have to make any effort, that happiness comes into the mind and the body. And once you have happiness in the mind and body, you don't have to make any effort, you don't have to think, you don't have to plan. Oh, may my body and mind become tranquil. It's an important thing, I haven't mentioned yet, on this point. When you are happy, it's much easier to sit still. The body relaxes very easily when you're in a good mood. But if you're upset, if you are angry, if you are guilty or whatever, sometimes the body will always be moving around. It'll be a restless body. And the trick, the cause of a still body, just the body being still, is happy mind. So get a little bit of happiness in, then your body can relax and you can sit for long periods of time. It's interesting, that's actually the cause of it. They said, once you have a tranquil body and a tranquil mind, you don't need to plan and think, oh, may my mind have this beautiful sense of bliss. It just happens naturally. And once you have bliss in your mind, you don't have to plan and think, oh, may I now go into jhanas. It happens naturally, it's automatic. They said, once you're in jhanas, and this is one of the important little statements which people don't understand, and maybe, if I do give a talk on insight tomorrow, this is what I would mention. Once you have jhanas, you don't have to plan, you don't have to make effort. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. In other words, get wisdom. It's automatic, it happens naturally. That when you emerge from a jhana, you will see things as they truly are. You will get wisdom. You don't have to think, oh, now I will do insight. All these things happen naturally. And once you get insight, you don't need to think, oh, may I now get enlightened. It just happens. And that whole little sutta of the Buddha, of the natural process, cause and effect, where you don't get involved, you don't steal the car because you've given the keys to Ajahn Brahma, whoever, is a very beautiful sutta of the Buddha. But we all have different similes and make different similes. And this is one of the good ones by Ajahn Chah. I don't know a similar metaphor in the suttas to just sitting under a mango tree and things fall. It was, you know, pretty much Ajahn Chah's. He may have got it from another monk, because these similes, they go around. But, you know, that's the nearest one in the suttas to that. But it is a very, very beautiful simile. And I've used it a lot because I heard this, it was, again, 39 years ago, when I first went to Ajahn Chah's monastery. And he would have these similes and repeat them again and again and again for about a month or 2 months. And then another simile would become his favorite, and he wouldn't say that again. And I never heard that again from Ajahn Chah. So I forgot it for years and years and years, that simile. It just went out of my mind, because I thought it was stupid and silly. I couldn't understand it. And it was only much later, you know, 20, 30 years later, I remembered what he said, because then it made sense to me. And that's why I repeat it now. And, you know, that simile of Ajahn Chah is not in any book of Ajahn Chah which I have read, because other monks must have forgotten it too. So the latest book which I wrote, The Good, Bad, Who Knows, which is mostly a lot of stories, I put it in that book because I didn't know any other place I could put it, and it's such a fantastic story, so I just include it in there. Now those books which I write, they're not just all jokes, some are jokes and silly stories, some are very profound, and that's one of the most profound stories, so it's actually now in Good, Bad, Who Knows. So it's a brilliant story, I love that one. Here we go, nuns. You showed your strong support for gender equality, e.g. nuns, and you support gay people's rights. But what is the teaching of the Buddha on gay people? Explanation of what other leading monks and Buddhist communities think about gay people. Now, I remember just basically Indian culture hasn't discriminated for centuries against gays. They've been part of society and respected. And I read recently, I'll probably get the dates wrong, but one of the British viceroys of India, I think it was Lord Macaulay, in sometimes about 1850 or something. You know, the British went into India and they imposed their culture on India. And he was the one, now under pressure from other people probably, he introduced as law in India that gays were unnatural and homosexual sex was illegal. And it was imposed by the British. And only recently, you know, the Indian government has got around to repealing that law. And I remember reading some of the argument. They said this was imposed by a foreign culture. It's not indigenous Indian culture to discriminate against gays. It was very European and very Christian. And it's the same even, you know, living in Thailand. You know, the gays are totally accepted and there's no discrimination at all against gay people in Thailand. It seems to be the places where Buddhism was, and it hasn't been changed by, you know, colonialism, that is beautiful, healthy. You know, you want to be gay, there's no problem at all. Just be a good gay. So there is, you know, basically many of the monks and nuns who have actually seen sort of what original authentic Buddhism was, there's no problem at all, you know, with gays. Obviously, if there is a gay man living in a community other monks, you know, there can be a problem. So I remember the first man who ordained, you know, he's a gay, very openly gay, who ordained at Bodhinyana Monastery. You know, I was, you know, obviously careful. I said, well, you know, what would happen, you know, if you're staying here and this hot guy came in and he had lots of lust? And he said, I'll just go to my room and lay down and hide. You know, because he really wanted to become a monk. It's basically, can you handle your sexuality? And, you know, he proved he could. And he's a quite a well-known monk now. I won't say who he is. But, you know, he's a wonderful monk. And he's a great teacher as well. Now, it's the same with, like, monks. They see a beautiful girl comes in the monastery. Now, what do? And they say the same thing. You've got to handle your sexuality, whether you're gay or whether you're straight, it doesn't really make any difference. Once you're a monk, you say no to sexuality. You're celibate. So it's whether you can handle that or not. That's not the only problem. So if you find you can't handle it, you know, just as a gay man living with another community of monks, you get too hot all the time, it's not suiting you at all. So, you know, you probably have to try another way of living a spiritual life. In the same way, if a monk has a lot of sexuality with the girls he sees, it gets very difficult. So it's just how you can handle that sexuality. That's the only thing. No discrimination about boys and girls and gays. It's just, this is a celibate life. Can you be celibate? That's it. And obviously, sometimes there was some problems. Especially, I remember somebody, I went to a last year, I'm also president of the Australian Sangha Association, which tries to unite all the monks and the nuns of all the traditions in Australia so we can work together. And last year, at our AGM and conference, we did have a talk by Professor Allen, he's at Australian National University, on gay monks in Thailand in the early time of the Ratanakosin era. That's, you know, after the fall of Ayutthaya. And, you know, there was lots of records. This is very interesting. The monks in Bangkok, you know, this was just after the fall of Ayutthaya kingdom, so the first Rama, the first and second, they didn't really have much organization. And the monks in Bangkok lived a very lovely life. They were very wealthy. And they would always have toy boys. And it was well known they'd take their young boys over to the barges and get fine Chinese silks for them. And it was just the done thing in those days. And obviously it's totally against the rules, but it was a case that, you know, with the fall of the Ayutthaya kingdom, the whole governance of Thailand was in turmoil, and even with the monks it was in turmoil too. And so they had those gay stories. And even now, in apparently Thai soap operas, quite often they have, like, monks who have homosexual lovers in the monasteries in Bangkok. That's like a Thai soap opera stuff. Obviously, that's totally against the rules, and that's one of the reasons why people think, oh, just Buddhism in Thailand is corrupt. It's not corrupt. There's some really good monks as well. But Even though, you know, you're not supposed to have sex with a woman or with a man or talk or anything like that. That's only with the monks. When it gets to the lay communities in Thailand, homosexuality is so accepted, which is really nice. So basically, there's no problem at all as far as I can see. And at least I remember some homosexuals in Perth. They said, at last, they told me personally, at last we can have a religion which accepts us and loves us and doesn't discriminate against us. And just, what a wonderful thing that is. Yeah, I'm sure there's one or two people who are gay here. I don't care, not my concern. But I do know that it's wonderful they can feel accepted. So don't discriminate. It's wonderful that they're here. Ha ha ha. Here we go, another nun question. But this is one out of a bit left field. Dear Ajahn, nuns are getting thinner and thinner due to much work at Dharmasala. Why not swap monasteries so that nuns can have completed one and monks can kill more kuti in that large block of land so they can get thinner and thinner and thinner? That's not what it says, I added that. Monks and nuns can't resist this, as all supposed to be non-stick. Many thanks. I don't know. But anyway, and I think what you mean is you're not supposed to be attached to your place. And so, no, we've talked about this with our monks. And the plan is we wait till the nuns have finished building it, and then we'll swap. No, that's the nuns' place, and the nuns will build it their way. And it's important that you build it and you live there, because then you'll think you've earned your monastery. And it's really important to do that. And the monks who have built Bodhinyana Monastery, like me, it's a great thing to do. You don't get that thin. You know, you're all really healthy and strong. And if you look at them, okay, they may look sort of skinny, but they're tough and they're strong. You go over there and watch them work. You'll get tired, they won't. So go and test them out. Sometimes just because you're thin doesn't mean you're not really tough. So they're in pretty good health. They all get looked after. So they're not exploited. You said time spent on meditation would add up for the bonus. Will that add up a bit by bit if I do meditation every day for even a small amount of time rather than not doing it at all? I think what I was talking about, the simile of the person going on the building site. You know, they work 4 days, gets nothing. On the fifth day, they get paid, so they decide to go on Friday after that. That will spoil in a bit of a joke. But is it the case that if you just spend, you know, maybe 1 minute of meditation every day, then that actually gives the same benefit of, 1 hour of meditation? No, but you do 1 minute sort of for 60 years. Is that the same as doing 1 hour a day for 1 year? And of course it doesn't work like that. You know, because if you just do 1 minute of work over, you know, one minute of meditation every day, then it takes you 60 years to catch up. By that time, what you get in 1 year is, you know, it's because of inflation, it's not worth anything after 60 years. So it doesn't work that way. The point is, when people actually ask, as they do ask, and as I will talk about at the end of the retreat, they say, how should we meditate when we get home here? And a common question is, how often should we meditate a day? How many hours a day? And the standard answer, which is a very good one, is how long do you spend every day eating? And as a rule of thumb, spend the same amount of minutes meditating as you do eating. If you eat a lot, you need to meditate a lot. Because you can always find time for eating. Therefore, you can find time for meditating. A nice rule of thumb. Your emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. So, for in the retreat, you have not mentioned the most important important posture, the posture of your mouth. Could you kindly also mention about how to ride on joy, not just a Hyundai, but also a Ferrari, if one happens to receive a Ferrari, but do not know how to manage such power. Okay, this refers to a couple of my similes. Now, I know when I started meditation, people would make a lot of emphasis on your posture. Number one, don't sit on a chair. That's being a lazy, namby-pamby cream puff. Sit on the floor in full lotus. Make your back perfectly straight, your chin stuck in. And even when you put your right hand over your left hand, not your left hand over your right hand, otherwise it won't work. And have your thumbs just slightly touching, not apart, but slightly touching. And your eyes closed, but not screwed down tight. Your chin tucked in. Get your posture perfect first. Otherwise, it won't work. That was a lot of what we call in Buddhism, Gomayang. She knows what that means. Go is a Pali word for bull. Mayang is the Pali word from what comes out of the bottom of a bull. But even though I've said some naughty words here, I'm not going to say the English equivalent for go mayang. But I think you've all worked out what it is now. Does anyone doesn't know the English meaning of go mayang now? B-U-L-L. S-H, you know the rest. So, instead of upsetting people by saying naughty words, you call it Gomayang. So you can learn something here, and if your husband says something stupid, that's a lot of Gomayang. And then you learn a word, which is good. So, the posture is not important, as long as you're relaxed. You can put your hands wherever you want. You can cross your legs or put them out, or however you feel comfortable. And your back, apparently, somebody sent me an article from a physiotherapy magazine and said people who sit with a straight back nearly always get back problems later in their life. So that's me. And that's, but my back is pretty good. So the most comfortable and healthiest position for your back is leaning back about 15 degrees, which you will notice is precisely the angle that the back of your chair is inclined. And the reason that is the case is that it's just the evolution. The chairs which sell well are the ones which are the most comfortable. And so over all the centuries of building chairs, that is the best posture. So according to physiotherapists, no, Sue, you're a physiotherapist. Did you see that article about the best posture for the back? No. It was in there somewhere. About 15 degrees, exactly what those chairs make you do. So if you want a healthy back, sit on a chair and just lean back. Don't lean forward. Lean back. And that is the healthiest posture, apparently. So, some of these ideas of postures which you read in these books are, again, Gomayang. They haven't got a rational explanation. It's not the case if you sit straight, the energy will flow up your spine, feeling. But if you bend over, the energy can't flow and then you never get into jhanas and stuff. That is Gomayang. But, if there is something important with your posture, there is one thing which I recommend, which is crucial if you're going to get into deep meditation with your posture. Not your legs, not your back, not your hands, but your face. The posture of your mouth is crucial. If your mouth is in this posture. That is bad mouth posture. It's not conducive to success in meditation. But that is correct meditation posture. Now you think, okay, that's just New Age rubbish. but it actually works. When I was at Cambridge, I got caught up into the boat club. This was not a stupid thing I did. I was stupid. Because, now they had these socials where they gave free sherry. Good stuff as well, not rubbish. These were the days before I had precepts. So you go there, have as much sherry as you want. And afterwards, you know, you find you signed up for the boat club and had to do all this stupid rowing stuff. And totally I got caught up in that. And before I knew it, you were in these boats, pulling these oars as fast as you could, trying to win races. I was never competitive. Even these days, I'm not competitive. And what would I got myself into? And I was on one race, and the only thing I learned from rowing was a very important lesson. I was in one race, and it's a lot of hard work. You really get sort of a lot of pain in just pulling this oar, trying to keep up with everybody else. And if you know those races, you know, there's always a coach on a bicycle on the footpath with a megaphone shouting at you, faster, do this, do that. And he shouted at me, "You are making an ugly face. Smile, for goodness sake." And of course, you know, you were really working hard, trying to pull that oar as fast as you can. Of course I had an ugly face. It was hurting. But at least, in those days, I was always up for suggestions. Now, I would try anything. So, okay, I smiled. I forced a smile. And I learned from that time on, the oar became easier to pull. You know, ask any psychologist, if you grit your teeth, everything is hard. If you smile, it's so much easier. Now, you're going to have a baby soon, Celeste. Don't grit your teeth. Smile, and the baby comes out much easier. It's absolutely true. And I learned that, you know, through that sport and everything else, doing examinations, whatever it is, smile, the answers come out much better. And they do. It's simple, but it's amazing how powerful that is. And I also use that for meditation. If you grit your teeth, psychologically you block progress in meditation. So a lot of the times, if you are not developing in the meditation, you're not going deep, the piti sukha, the happiness is not there. Take your attention away from your breath or whatever it is you're watching, put it on your mouth and force a smile. Fake one. That's all you need to do. And straight away, that creates happiness inside your mind. You go back into the mind, and then you're off on some wonderful meditation. And it's amazing just how well that works in life. That is the best posture. Everything else is not important, but the smile actually does work. And the second part of the question they had here, kindly also mentioned about how to ride on joy. Now, the simile between, like, say, a Ford or a Ferrari, I've got a Hyundai and a Ferrari. We've mentioned Hyundai because there's many people from Korea here. So we're talking about this amazing vehicle which you've made, the Hyundai Motor Company. So if you are riding a Hyundai, it's a very reliable vehicle, but it's not one of those fast sports cars, at least I've never seen one of those yet. So it's easy to drive a Hyundai. But then there comes a time you have a Ferrari. Can you handle the power? And this simile is in meditation. A lot of times you're just going along and it's nice and peaceful. But then you get into especially these nimitta stages, you get some powerful mind states. And so sometimes you get a bit scared. No, I can handle a Hyundai or a Ford, but not a Ferrari. That's just got too much power behind its engine. So part of this simile was to learn in the deep meditations you have an incredibly powerful mind. Learn how to drive it well. And all the keys and tips to driving it, you've heard already. Just let it go. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then the very powerful mind states you have, it's like you've got a Ferrari for a mind. And it's amazing to have so much fun with that. So that's like the Ferrari mind. But a lot of times, We've got some old bomb of a mine which should have been taken off the road years ago. That's when you're stopped and torpor or thinking all over the place. This is a mine which can travel. It's good fun having such a mind. It's not that hard to learn how to drive. But when you first get powerful mind states, you have a lot of crashes. Beautiful nimittas, and then it's gone again. You crash. But after a while, you can learn how to use that power, and the nimitta stays. And whoosh! And it gets bigger and more powerful. Yes! You have a great time. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, what is your tip advice on teaching children Dhamma? My son, husband and I listen to your CD every day in the car. I notice my son absorb easily from some of your teachings. For example, when I raised my voice at home, then he looked at me and said, "Peace." For those of you who don't know, our local newspaper, I'll probably get a few copies here for you. Our local newspaper on Saturdays had a big article about me in their magazine, in the West Australian weekend edition. They've been doing this for a while. It's the reporter, is the senior reporter, Colleen Egan. And she was telling me that the reason why she's doing this big feature article in the magazine on me is because her kids listen to my talks. And they also read the book. She reads the book, Open the Door of the Heart, to them. And the one story her son, who's about 10 years old, likes the best, she emailed me this, was the thing of what's done is finished. Because that story, if you don't know it, from Open the Door of Your Heart, was of this monk who was building his hall, and when it came to the retreat time, he sent all the builders home. A few days later, a visitor came and saw this hall with no windows in, the roof was just mostly open, cement bags everywhere, and it asked the monk the obvious question, when is the building going to be completed? And the monk answered, the building is finished. He said, what? Are you going to leave it like this with no windows, cement bags all over the place, a mess? And the monk replied, sir, what's done is finished. And then he went off to meditate. And that was such a brilliant response. What's done is finished. So at the end of the day, when you finish your work, you don't take anything home with you. Otherwise, your work is never finished. That is how we can have some peace in life. Look, your business, your housework, your monastery, jhana grove, when on earth is this going to be finished? When is Dhammasara going to be finished, Venerable Karunika? It is finished, she says. What's done is finished. And then she can come on retreat and have a good time. Now, the reason why the 10-year-old son liked that story, because I also added that many years ago when I said that story in, again, our city centre in Noramara, I said it on a Friday night. On a Sunday, a Sri Lankan family came to complain. They said, our son listened to that talk with us. On Saturday evening, he was about 16 or 17, he went out to a party. And the husband said, son, have you finished your homework? Remember, the deal was you finish your homework before you go out to the party. And his son said, just as Ajahn Brahm said, Dad, what's done is finished. See you tomorrow. He hadn't finished his homework. He just said, what's done is finished. And so I got into trouble for that. And I wrote that in my book. And that's exactly what this reporter's 10-year-old son keeps on saying. In there, is your room clean, son? Is it tidied up yet? What's done is finished, Mum. Kids are great. So that's why you've got to be very careful, because sometimes the kids can use these things to their advantage. He also loves to say, sadhu, 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 your way, and laugh, since you are so lovable. Yeah. It's when you make fun and have joy. Of course the kids love that. They love things which is fun and joy. If you organise any camp for kids, that would be great. I know, of course it would be great. You dump the kids in Jhana Grove. And you have a lovely holiday. And I have to deal with it. Oh, God. That would be great. We are interstate and not able to attend weekly class for kids. Although I already think to move to Perth. Stop thinking, be present. Thank you. Yeah, it's great to have. We do have. Lee runs kids' classes, so she's brilliant with the kids over at our city centre. So, yeah, I'm sure you can arrange that somewhere, get a few like-minded people, and you know, you can put fun into these things. The book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, was very successful, and many of my talks are very successful. And one person, he was some doctor of PhD, he came up to me, and he was very smart. He said, I know why your talks are so successful and popular, because you talk to us, Ajahn Brahm, as if we were children, and tell jokes and funny stories, simple stories. And because you treat us all like children, we love it. In a good way. You know, I just mess around with you. You have teddy bears, for goodness sake. That's really infantile, but it's fun. And all the stories. You don't treat people like they're intellectual professors at university and say all lots of big words which no one understands. So keep it simple. And if the children can understand it, then you can understand it. So that's why it really works. The books in Indonesia, they became real number one bestsellers. You know, they're in the bookshop, big piles of them with a that you may have seen it in the books, a big cardboard cutout of me in the big bookshops in Indonesia. And those are my books, the number one bestsellers. And the reason they become a number one bestseller, they put a cartoon on the front cover. Of a worm in a pile of dung. And, they're called Chaching. And the whole Chaching series of books, everybody knows it now. Everybody almost in Indonesia. It's such a popular series. And just because it was a cartoon and people thought this is a kid's book. Or is it a kid's book? It's both. And that's why it works. So if you're ever teaching, don't teach people as if they were a university. Teach down to earth. If a child can understand it, then everybody can. So that's why the teachings here, the kids do listen to it, and they do get a lot out of it, which is great. Next question. Ha, no pen. Is this a subtle attempt to stop more questions? Well, it didn't work, because I just went and found one. Ha ha. So obviously there was no pen around there when somebody wrote this question. And it wasn't a subtle attempt. It was just even pens can listen to these teachings. And because they're sitting there so still, they disappear. They vanish. So even the pens have got into jhana. Is it important how to place the hands in meditation? Are you right once there for a finger thumb touching, or the knee, etc., or simply meaningless ritual? It's amazing just how you say an answer and the question comes up afterwards. So I've already mentioned that. You can put your hands anywhere you like. If you really want to get some deep meditation, put one in your ear, the other one up your nose, and then meditate. Try it. Prove me wrong. You could do that. And if I was really mean, I'd get you all doing that the first day of meditation. And take a picture, and you'd all do it. Now this is the new meditation. And then take a photo of you all, put it in a magazine, and just show how gullible people are. Yeah, this is the only way to get into jhanas. You've got to put your hands like this. No, it doesn't matter where or how you put your hands.